U.S.-Israel alliance war with Iran is now 10 weeks old. At the Geopolity, we thought this would be a good time to take your questions about the conflict and review where things stand and where things will possibly go. Here to help me navigate your questions is Geopolity founder Adnan. Hope you're well, Adnan.
Good, Imam. I'm good. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well. I want to remind everyone that you can find us on all major social media platforms where you can subscribe and never miss a thing. So Adnan, the first question that I want to ask is we've passed the 10-week mark. What's the latest with the war?
So after 10 weeks, the war really hasn't turned out the way Donald Trump believed it would and even what he hoped. But 10 weeks in, the regime hasn't fallen. In fact, the regime has shown it's quite resilient. In fact, everything America has done and it plans to do has actually failed. And that's why I feel Trump's tweets are getting more and more bonkers. Trump's tweets are sounding more and more silly. They're sounding more and more wild. He's now in a situation he's never been in before. He's completely out of his league. He's not a strategist. This regime was supposed to fall in 3 days. He will be the greatest president ever. He deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. 10 weeks in, everything America has thrown at Iran, it hasn't worked, and it's actually unlikely to work. And I'm sure we're going to talk about this now. This opens up a whole can of worms about Trump, the midterms, the American empire, the American position globally. So 10 weeks in, this is turning into another Iraq-Afghanistan disaster. That's why you're not seeing the famous Mission Accomplished banner. What you're seeing is Trump's tweets. What you're seeing is, does Trump still mean this morning what he meant last night? You know, I actually feel in 100 years, when they look back at this war, they'll have maps, they'll have videos, they'll have reports. They'll also have a timeline of Trump's tweets, and they'll be trying to make sense of what on earth was going on. But Trump seems to have been constantly contradicting himself. So Iran has survived for the moment. And in many ways, the ball is in America's court. What are you going to do? And I'm sure we'll go through what are the options available to them.
Yep. Why did Trump launch this war? You know, all his officials are telling him it's a bad idea, but he still continues with the war.
So the New York Times covered this. They gave a blow-by-blow account of the run-up to the war, how the decision was made. And it's actually, some of it's really funny and some of it's really concerning. You've got PowerPoint presentations taking place in the Situation Room, not by American officials, not by American senators, by Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel and by the head of Mossad. What we do know is the decision was made over Christmas. This was when Netanyahu visited Washington. That's when the agreement was made for war. And this is very interesting. So that means for at least 2 months, the talks that were going on between Iran and America were absolutely pointless because the decision had already been made to go to war. Now, Trump believed the war would be over quickly. It wouldn't impact his domestic position. And if you go to the State Department website, it actually says there that the reason why they did this war was to protect and defend against Israel, which is even more worrying because the MAGA crowd, their biggest problem here is that we're going to war over Israel. So what Trump has said is we did this war because of nuclear weapons and things like that. And there is some truth to that. What we do now know is Israel played quite a central role for this war to happen. However, we can see now that a lot of the decision making was down to or goes down to Donald Trump's personal opinion, his personal belief that this would make him a great president and this would actually aid his personal position. So this is all very, very worrying, considering this is how decisions are made to go to war.
Adnan, what do you think is going to end first? Trump's presidency or the Iran war?
Both. So I think the war's going to go on for some time now. We're talking weeks and months. And although Trump said the war's about to finish, I think we've heard this enough now to know he's just lying, just barefaced lies. Some of this could be to actually put pressure on Iran that, you know, if you don't finish this war immediately, if you don't come to the negotiating table, we're going to really, really escalate. I think with Trump, it's not like there's a full-scale invasion. You've got lots of troops in the region. A lot of American resources are being devoted to this. That hasn't happened yet. They devoted special operation forces. They devoted some military resources because they thought it was going to be a quick war. in any quick war, you don't obviously deploy, you don't do mass mobilization. So from that perspective, I think the impact on the American public and American public opinion, I don't think it will be too much. However, we're seeing now oil prices, we're seeing the economic impacts of this, and that could impact Trump's position. I think he's definitely going to lose one house in the midterms in November. There's a possibility he may lose both houses. And from that point onwards, he'll be a lame duck president. He won't be able to pass laws. He won't be able to do anything. So just a few days ago, he said the war's over because he's got to the limit of his presidential capabilities where he can launch a war without having Congress approval. He's now got to the point where he has to seek Congress approval for resources, for financing for the war. And what he said is the war's over. So this is the game you can see he's playing. So I think this is going to go on still for weeks and months. That's going to be very painful for most of the world. I don't think there's enough for him to get overthrown. I mean, there's talk of impeaching him, but the Republicans won't do that. If you impeach him, it's going to cause problems for the Republicans. And Donald Trump is the Republican Party at the moment. He's effectively hijacked the whole party. So I think what's likely to happen is he'll become a lame duck president. And that obviously will open up all sorts of worms.
How has Israel been able to influence President Trump? In the New York Times article that you mentioned, it was Netanyahu who was at the head of the table and Trump was pretty much sitting on the side. So how has Israel been able to gain such an influence?
So all of this is possible because the president of America, Donald Trump, is a narcissist, he's vain, he's short-sighted, and he lacks any strategic thinking. This makes it much more easier to convince him of doing an action because what you do is you tap into all these characteristics. Now, Trump's calculations, and this is becoming more and more clear, all his calculations were, how will this make me look? So if this is a quick war, it's like Venezuela, I'm going to look really, really good. I deserve a Nobel Peace Prize. So that's what the Israelis tap into. We've got to keep in mind, Netanyahu has been trying to begin, he's been trying to start a war with Iran going back to the 1990s. He tried to push President Bush, who out of all the presidents we've had since then, you'd think he'd be the one that would roll over. He didn't. He tried it with Obama. He tried it with Biden. Biden is like a born and bred Zionist. Trump is the one. Because Trump, the way he is and the way he is as an individual, they were really able to pull on the right strings. Now, we know all of Trump's advisors told him this is a really, really bad idea. So the chairman of the military, Trump asked him, and the head of the military said is that the Israelis are blaggers. Everything they say is usually lies. Iran isn't as weak as they make it out to be. And he said, Mr. President, we'll be left doing the heavy lifting if we do this. But he still said, Mr. President, the decision's yours. So we know in the end, the calculations for the decision here wasn't based on strategy, wasn't based on changing the political reality. A lot of it was based on how will this aid me politically as a president of America? And if it does, I'm prepared to actually do it. I think the broader question here really is the ability or the influence Israel has over America. And we know that this has been a discussion point in America amongst MAGA. You know, it's all about America first, even before Israel. Now, we know Israel is heavily invested in America. It invests in lobbying. It funds numerous senators. And it has support in the state, in the media, and amongst the rich in America. So John Mersheimer has outlined the pro-Israel community, if we can call them that, in America. And he says that, look, you've got the Christian evangelicals who support Israel for their end of times agenda. Then you have people who believe Israel is a forward base for America in the Middle East. Therefore, we should support them. We should arm them. So they, from a foreign policy perspective, they see Israel as an ally who supports American interests. Then the third part is those people who pro-Israelis fund, they lobby, and for their own personal political ambitions, they are pro-Israel. If you put that all together, what that means is being pro-Israel and doing policies in line with Israel, there's a big movement in America. And John Mersheimer has for years been outlining this. So fundamentally, America looks at Israel as its base in the region. So we need to arm it. We need to fund it. We need to give them a prosperous standard of living. And in return, you know, America gets a return on their investment. Now, there are some issues. There are some problems. But overall, that's why Israel does have a say or does get a seat on American policy in the Middle East. And then on top of that, when you have a president like Trump, who's very short-term and lacks strategic thinking, it's a lot more easier to pull in the right strings.
Why do you think the US decapitation plan failed?
So the decapitation strategy failed because the assumptions it was built upon were, I'll say it's just bonkers. The assumption was Iran is some fragile regime held together by one man's supreme leader. So naturally from there, if you take out the one man, the whole thing will fall apart. Now, this isn't too different to Russia's strategy in Ukraine. The president is corrupt. You've got a small elite who are looting the country. If we roll into Kiev, the whole thing will unravel. Clearly, that didn't happen. So what you find, this strategy had three parts to it. You have shock and awe, which is we carry out strikes to paralyze the ability of Iran to respond. Then you had the decapitation strike. What that means is you kill the top leadership so the regime collapses. And then when the regime collapses, you've got part three, which is this sparks protests so the elites then defect. So what you get is like a Venezuela outcome, yeah, where whatever's left, they just come to America and say, we're prepared to negotiate. Now, none of this worked in the end. Well, they killed the leadership, they carried out their strikes, but the outcomes they wanted, none of that actually happened in the end. And there's a few reasons for that. Firstly, look, the Iranian regime, like every regime in the world, is never one man. What you've got is lots of people, lots of factions, and even institutions. America and the West have made out Iran to be some dictatorship or an oligarch, and that's how the country is run. This country has elections, it has a president, it has a parliament, it has a guardian council, it has a supreme leader, it has institutions. So it's more than one person. The other thing that happened, or what America didn't take into account, was that the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, they held the state together. They battened down this time around, and they held the country together, and they've actually fought back. The third thing was the protests were completely overblown. Now, anybody who follows Iranian politics, you will know, the Iranians are always protesting. You have people who hate the regime. You have people who believe the regime is too Islamic. You have people who believe the regime is corrupt. They are always protesting. Protests happen all the time. But the protests in January, America and the West gave it a lot of coverage. Why? Because in December, they'd all decided they're going to invade the country. So when the protests happened in January, they used that for the plan that had already been agreed. So this was not a plan made on the 28th of February when they invaded. The plan to invade actually happened in Christmas period. And that's why when the protests happened, they thought we could use this to our advantage. So these were completely overblown. And finally, what the US and Israel has now done has actually strengthened the regime. People have got behind the regime. People in Iran are shocked that Iranians abroad are supporting the bombing campaign against Iran. So what America's decapitation plan has actually now strengthened the regime.
The US, with all its military might, it's not been able to reopen the Straits of Hormuz. Why is that?
One reason, fundamentally, because of Iran. They've not been able to open it because Iran refused to budge. Iran has closed it, and America has been unable to change this reality. So the only way America will be able to open the Straits of Hormuz is they need to force it open. So they've carried out attacks that have failed. They actually even invaded. There was a story of where a jet went down in Iran and America sent in lots of forces to go and get the soldiers. We now know what actually happened was this was an invasion to go and get the uranium resources, and it was a complete disaster. So invasion has failed. Talks are failing and they're not succeeding. The US has failed to shape Iranian behavior. So there's only one reason why the Straits of Hormuz is closed, is because Iran is closing it and America has failed and they cannot do anything about that. Until they can't alter this simple fact, the Straits of Hormuz will remain closed.
And on a political level, what's been the impact of the Straits being closed?
Well, the impact is huge. And I think we're just at the starting point, really, of the impact this is going to have. So we're seeing oil prices go up and fluctuate quite significantly. That's having a knock-on effect now on petrol prices, on the price of plastics, is even affecting gold, gas prices as well. Gas prices going up across the world. So, you know, to a producer, that's a good thing. But if you're a consumer, it means the amount you're having to pay for fossil fuels now is going through the roof. Fertilizer prices are going up as well because oil is used to produce fertilizers. Helium prices are going up as well. This is used as a byproduct for many, many other things. There's talk now of a global recession. We're seeing in a number of nations, shortages are starting to occur now. So some countries are talking about having 4-day weeks now to try and conserve energy. And what this has shown is you can take on a superpower if you control a choke point. A choke point is a narrow passageway which global trade supply and global energy supply lines rely on. And if you bring this choke point to a closure, you can hold the whole world hostage. This is effectively how Iran has defended itself against America. It's not taken on America directly. What they've done is, we're going to control this choke point, and 30% of energy comes from this region. So they're now holding the world to ransom. And that's why everyone's turning against America now, the Global South, the Far East, and even Europe. So the impact is huge. And 10 weeks ago, there were talks going on between America and Iran. America didn't need to do this. They've now created a problem of their own creation.
So, Osman, during this war, one of the conversations I've had is this just a drama between US and Iran? It's you know, they've got their own interests at hand, and it'll be over soon. And I think this is one of the questions that's actually come through as well from our listeners. What's your thoughts on that?
So I think this question's come from a particular understanding of the relationship between Iran and America. Iran and America have cooperated in the past. So although what we hear is Iran is a state sponsor of terrorism, it's a source of instability in the Middle East, it's going to cause even more instability when it acquires nuclear weapons. That's what we hear from America. From Iran, what we hear is, you know, America the great shaitan, America the devil, Iran is anti-imperialist, it's trying to save the region. So based on that, you know, you'd think they're enemies. However, in Iraq and Afghanistan, America and Iran cooperated with each other. In Afghanistan, Iran secured the north of the country. That meant that the insurgency was only in the south of the country, which America was able to focus on. American officials have praised Iran for its role in Afghanistan. The Iranian Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, he would go to the UN meetings in America and he would go on TV and say, look, we, America and us, work together because we have the same interest in Afghanistan, which is to keep the Taliban out. In Iraq, America actually initially invaded and Iran said, let's work together. And America wasn't interested. When the insurgency got really, really bad, what they did was they reached out to the Iranians. And what the Iranians did is all the pro-Shia groups in the south of Iraq that Iran supports, all of them then entered America's political system and the elections that were done. So Iran actually played a very, very central role in aiding America and stopping them from bleeding to death in Iraq and Afghanistan. So when you put that together, you would question, is this just a drama playing out? Because these two countries have actually been working together. These two countries had a nuclear deal in the past. America was the one that broke it. These two countries have sat down multiple times to talk about the nuclear program and to talk about the actual region. However, look, Iran does have its own interest in the region. Iran wants to have its own empire. Iran, because of historical reasons, believes it's a regional power. And it believes that America has to engage with Iran because Iran's the power in the region. From the American perspective, when they look at this region, Iran is this huge country. So America feels it needs to manage Iran, because Iran could be the power in the region and they don't want to share the region with anybody. So America really moves between engaging with Iran when it needs her, and then it contains Iran, makes it a pariah, puts sanctions on it in order to contain it. This has been America's approach. This is why America can work with Iran when it wants to, and it could actually work against Iran in order to contain it. So when you put that together, it can come across, isn't this just a drama? Because for the last two decades, they were working together. Then all of a sudden they're enemies. From America's perspective, there's no such thing as a permanent ally and friend. You know, everyone should know that. Whoever is an enemy can be an ally tomorrow. Whoever's an ally today can be an enemy going forward as well. This is real. It's not a drama. America wants Iran to effectively capitulate, surrender, and just work with America on America's terms. What Iran is saying is, you effectively want us to cut our arms and legs off. You want us to give up our nuclear weapons. You want us to give up our militia groups or proxy groups in the region, and we're not prepared to do that. So this is real. It's not fake. It's not a drama. And the lesson Iran should have learned is if you get in bed with the devil, you're going to get burnt. And unfortunately, they're learning that the hard way now.
Where is Iran's air force and its army?
That's a good question, actually, because especially the air force, you know, we keep hearing Iran's got this great military, you know, where is it? I think it's important. We've got to put Iran's conventional and unconventional capabilities into perspective. When the revolution happened in 1979, the Shah had built this massive military force in the Middle East. He was part of the Western camp when it came to the Cold War, and he'd built up this great military. So when the clerics took over in the 1979, they didn't trust the army. They thought the army were the Shah's army and they could do a coup against them. So what the clerics did was they set up the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, who were like the Republican Guard, completely loyal to them. So what's happened since then is the regime has really built and beefed up and given significant resources to the IIGC. So the IIGC now have smuggling corridors. They manage the country's ballistic missiles, which are their key military platforms. The Artesh, I think they call them, the conventional army, they've actually been quite neglected. And this actually poses a big problem for them to fight a conventional war. If Iran's air force was to take off from the ground, it would likely get destroyed. Iran's fixed-wing capabilities are all from the 1970s during the Shah's era. So you're looking at F-14 Tomcats, you're looking at F-4 Phantoms, you're looking at MiG-29s. These are very old aircraft. They're aging. There's limited access to spare parts. They've got weak radar, avionics, and electronic warfare. And actually, Iran's pilots do minimal training when you compare them to Western air doctrine. But Iran is not in a conventional war. Iran is actually fighting an unconventional war. So their war is through using ballistic missiles, it's through using cruise missiles, it's through using drones, the Shahid drone that we can hear from a mile away because of how loud their engines are. That's the war they're fighting. So the reason why you're not seeing Iran's air force and army is because the unconventional forces of Iran is what's in the war, and they are the most capable, and they're fighting an unconventional war. You're not seeing their conventional army because their conventional army is very weak. They will probably get destroyed. And as I explained, that the clerics have actually neglected them and weakened them for political reasons.
A common repeat question that we've received is, why does Israel hate Iran?
So they hate each other because they're competitors. Both of them have ambitions. Iran and Israel both have ambitions for the region. And when they look at the obstacles to that ambition, when they look at who the competition is, they see each other. Interestingly, during the Shah's era, Iran and Israel were very close allies in the region. Mossad had offices in Iran. Iranian secret service agents would regularly go to Tel Aviv. There was a big Jewish community from Israel in Iran. They had their schools, they had their areas. So during the Shah's era, they were very, very close. Then everything changed in 1979 when the revolution happened. When the revolution happened, there was all these slogans of Islam and spreading Shia Islam in the region. You had all of this. So this worried Israel because that means Iran's getting stronger and actually it's expanding in the region. However, very quickly, Iran and Iraq went to war. During the Iran-Iraq war, Israel supplied Iran with weapons to fight against Iraq. And because Israel and Iran had the same weapons from America during the Shah's era, they worked together. Then Iran supported Hezbollah when Israel went into Lebanon. And this support for Hezbollah then bumped up against Israel. And really what you find from the 1980s, Israel came to see Iran as a problem. It came to see it as an enemy. Iran started supporting groups like Hezbollah. You obviously had the Houthis in Yemen. You had Hamas in Palestine. So very quickly, Israel and Iran fell out and the relationship completely changed. So really since then, what's happened is most of the battle between Iran and Israel, it's been in the shadows. It's been via assassinations. It's been via cyber attacks. It's been via proxies. What's happened since October 7 is the war is open and direct and in the open now. So Israel has always wanted to attack Iran. It's always seen Iran as a problem. However, it lacks the capability. Iran is over 800 miles away from Israel. That would stretch Israeli capability. So Israel's always needed America to do this. And that's why Netanyahu, for the last two decades, he's been begging, funding, lobbying America to do this. And he got his wish in the end, and it's turned into a complete disaster.
Europe's role in this war has been quite interesting because they've essentially refused to be on America's side. Why is that?
So the reason why they refused is America didn't involve Europe in this war. It didn't involve them in the planning. It didn't tell Europe. It prosecuted the war. And that's when Europe found out that America's going to war. So as far as Europe is concerned, is we're allies. We helped you navigate Afghanistan and Iraq. We were there by your side. You screwed up. You got involved in an insurgency and we helped you. What also doesn't help is Trump keeps humiliating them. So Trump went in, and when Trump believed the war would be over really, really quickly, he started humiliating them. He started targeting Keir Starmer. He's fallen out with the Spanish leader. He's been attacking the German leader. But then when the war hasn't worked out and Trump was losing, he reached out to Europe. And Europe said, oh, now you want our help. You slag us off. You didn't inform us. You didn't treat us like an ally. And now that when things aren't working out, you want us to come and bail you out. So what Europe's done is it stood its ground. So now Europe, they're deciding how they are going to engage with Iran. So there's an alliance of European and Western nations that Britain has set up, which doesn't involve America. And what they're looking at now is how they're going to engage with Iran without America.
So we have received a few questions relating to Russia and China. Why has Russia and China not done with Ukraine on the US? And why has China not overtly helped Iran?
So both China and Russia, they have provided help, but it's been quite limited. And for the moment, it actually remains quite limited. So Russia is busy in Ukraine. It's 4 years in this war in Ukraine, which strategically is way more important to it than what happened in the Middle East. Alongside this, look, Russia has a working relationship with America. It doesn't want to jeopardize this. Since Trump's come to power, he's giving Russia everything in Ukraine. He's saying to Ukrainians, you have to negotiate with Russia. He's saying you have to give up territory to negotiate. And actually, when America's been talking to Russia, they've been talking about Ukraine and global energy. They've been talking about setting up projects in the Arctic. They've been talking about energy deals. So Russia and America actually have a pretty good relationship. Do you really want to jeopardize this? And I would even argue, how can Russia even help and weaken America in the Middle East? Russia got booted out of Syria. There was nothing it could do about it. Russia's position in Africa is really, really untenable. It's looking even weak. We just recently had attacks in Mali that's impacted them. So Russia's just being pragmatic here. Realistically, there's only so much help they can give Iran. What more can they do? China, from the other perspective, is it can't really project into the region. China is still trying to build its power in the Far East. Its military may be able to, one ship may be able to go far into the Middle East. It can't project in the region, doesn't have that level of capability. Then the other thing is, like Russia, China has its own battle going on with the US, and it doesn't really want to antagonize America. Now, if both of these countries, Russia and China, really wanted to help Iran, you're looking at spending up to $300 billion. If you look at the help America and the West have given to Ukraine, you're looking at hundreds of billions here. Both countries just aren't prepared to do that. You know, Iran isn't that important. So they would like to help Iran to bleed America. But to do more than that, they need to invest more and put in more capabilities, which they physically can't. So what does that mean? That means they need to provide aircraft, they need to provide tanks, they need to provide missiles, they need to provide air defense systems and other weapons. That's not happening, and it's not going to happen. So both Russia and China, they would like Iran to win. They would want Iran to hurt America. So that would impact how America engages with Russia and China. There is a final aspect in this we need to understand, that even Iran, it's like a reluctant friend when it comes to Russia and China. Russia and China have been looking to win over Iran for a really, really long time. There's all this talk about an alliance. As far as Iran's concerned, the global power is America. And they believe, the clerics believe, we need to have a good relationship with America, the superpower, because that will aid them in the region. And this has always been a problem for the Chinese and the Russians. The Chinese and the Russians are offering everything to Iran in terms of military equipment. But what they want is in return, is let's become allies, let's work together. Iran doesn't want that sort of relationship. What Iran wants is, let's have a relationship with you guys, but we also want a relationship with America. So the reason why China and Russia can't do Ukraine is it's actually a much more complicated picture. I know in the media, both Russia and China put out messaging that we're allies, we're there for each other. The reality, their relationship is much more complicated than that.
So going forward, based on what you just said, what's the chances of Iran aligning more with China and Russia?
I think it's possible, but I think a number of things need to happen, and there's probably a few things we need to look out for. Firstly, Russia and Iran have some written agreements. China and Iran apparently have this like defense like alliance together that they developed in the early 2020s. So first thing is, this needs to move from paper to reality. We're not seeing that at the moment. We're seeing, you know, a lot of signing of papers. We've got a defense agreement in place. We're allies. It needs to move from paper to reality. So what does that mean? It means that they need to agree on sophisticated weapons being transferred. It means there needs to be loans going on between both countries and blocs. It means that there needs to be closer coordination, that you're going to do this, we're going to do this when it comes to the US. It also means potentially Iran giving bases to Russia and China in the region. That hasn't happened until this point. However, if America really hurts Iran here, then this becomes more and more likely. So the more America hurts Iran, the more it decapitates them, the more it weakens them, the more chance of Iran aligning with China and Russia.
In terms of this war and the US and China, how much of this war is really about containing China?
So I think it's very likely here. I think a lot of this war really is about China. In fact, Iran, unfortunately, is probably a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. And this is quite common. You know, America and the superpowers historically, they do this. You know, you can do a political action and the end is the action itself, or the political action is a means to an end in itself. Now, I mentioned before, the US and Iran have had a cooperative relationship in the past, in Iraq and Afghanistan. Look, fundamentally for America, Iran doesn't pose a real, immediate, tangible threat in the region. What America wants to do is use Iran to achieve other things. So from that perspective, that raises the question, why is America doing this? And that supports the idea more that this is a means to an end. So the Straits of Hormuz being closed, America doing a blockade on top of a blockade. Most of the energy in the Straits of Hormuz, the Middle East, it goes to the Far East and some of it goes to Europe. So China is an oil consumer. So by the Straits of Hormuz being closed, by there being instability here, this has a big, big impact on China. And this is something China needs to understand. If you're not going to get involved in the region, if you're not going to put in the effort and the resources, well, this is all about you, really. And if this is all about you, maybe China should get more involved. Maybe China should really try and win the hearts and minds of the Iranian leadership and think about pouring more resources into this. But if you don't, America potentially is using Iran as a means to bleed you, as a means to actually weaken you. So I think this is definitely quite an interesting perspective that we need to keep monitoring going forward.
Another interesting question that we've been asked is, what are the chances of US or Israel using nuclear weapons against Iran? And even Iran, you know, testing a nuclear weapon, what are the chances of all this happening?
So the use of a nuclear weapon by any side, it'll be a disaster for everyone. Well, it'll be a disaster for the whole world, actually. This is a region that has 60% of the world's oil reserves. It has the largest gas reserves in the world. It's a key strategic location. So a nuke would create a massive radioactive crater, and oil, gas, energy prices would just go through the roof. So it's not in anyone's interest from that perspective. But we're going to put nuclear weapons into perspective. As far as Iran is concerned, the nuclear weapon is a bargaining tool. What Iran is saying to America, that if you remove sanctions, if you work with us, then we don't need a nuclear weapon. We can work together. However, if you make us a pariah, if you sanction us, if you isolate us, then the nuclear weapon is worth us pursuing because you're a threat to us. So this is a bargaining tool for Iran. So that's why in 2015, Iran gave significant concessions, humiliating concessions, to have sanctions removed and put its nuclear weapon on the shelf. So Iran has shown it is prepared to completely end its nuclear program for the right terms. So for Iran, it's a bargaining tool. As far as America's concerned, when they look at Iran, they want to use the nation. They want to work with the nation, whether that is in a subordinate manner, where we say jump and you jump, or they work together as allied countries. America doesn't want a radioactive crater in this region. Israel, any nuclear strike or any detonation in this region will affect Israel as well. Nuclear bombs don't respect borders. Nuclear bombs don't respect the boundaries and different peoples. So any use of a nuclear weapon in this region will affect everybody in the region. And as I mentioned, this is like the most strategic region in the world. We've also shown what happens when you close the Straits of Hormuz. You close the Straits of Hormuz, you've got global recession, oil prices going through the roof. The use of a nuke will be 10 times worse for the world if that's the case. So what this should show you, the use of nuclear weapon, I think it gets a lot of headlines. If you remember, we heard the use of nuclear weapons so many times in the Ukraine war. Here we are 4 years down the line. It's a bargaining tool. It's a tool to show you're serious. You don't really want to mess with us. And the use of a nuclear weapon would be against American interests. America wants to be the power in this region. It wants to dominate the resources. It wants to use them for its interests. A nuclear weapon is the complete opposite to that. You know, throughout America's post-World War II history, we've had examples of where America was losing and the generals have said, let's use a nuclear weapon. So the most famous example was in North Korea, 1952, the North Korean War. The Korean War. General MacArthur's army was being slaughtered by China and he proposed, let's use a nuclear weapon, and he got sacked. So, you know, even America knows, you know, this is not something you should do. And then finally, I would say, all the nations that have nuclear weapons, they have lost wars and not used their nuclear weapons. America was bleeding to death in Iraq and Afghanistan. There was never a suggestion for them to use nuclear weapons. The Soviet Union lost in Afghanistan. The Soviet Union was humiliated. They withdrew. They didn't use their nuclear weapons. The Americans were defeated in Vietnam. The war went on for too long. They still didn't use nuclear weapons. The French lost in Algeria, didn't use nuclear weapons. In 1979, the Chinese invaded Vietnam and they left and they didn't use their nuclear weapons. So just because you have a nuclear weapon doesn't mean you're going to use it. There are other political reasons to have a nuclear weapon. It's a bargaining tool as well. But I think it's very unlikely. If Iran was to test a nuclear weapon, the problem is you then lose that as a bargaining chip. The whole idea is by not having a nuke, you can use it as a bargaining chip. We will acquire a nuke. Once you've tested a nuclear weapon, well, you can't use that as a bargaining tool. You've got it now. And that opens up a whole other can of worms. You know, will America accept that? Will they do something about it? Will Iran be taken seriously? But by getting close to a nuclear weapon, not developing it, it's a bargaining tool that they can use.
You still stand by that, even though a narcissist president, Trump, is in power. I mean, he's actually said they may end up using a nuclear weapon.
Yes, I mean, look, he's not the first. Stalin wasn't exactly had his head screwed on properly. He was the one that developed the Soviet nuclear program. The North Koreans are always presented, the North Korean leader, is always presented as being mad. He hasn't used a nuclear weapon. Look, using a nuclear weapon, that's a whole different ball game. And actually, if America had used a nuclear weapon in Afghanistan, would they have won the war? They've lost lots of resources. 20 years went by. It wouldn't have actually made a difference in the end. So, you know, the Israelis apparently have a nuclear bomb. You've got this madman surrounded by even more madmen in the Israeli cabinet. It's been decades now. They haven't used a nuclear weapon. So what you find all of them do is it's an option. They threaten other countries. If you don't get into line, we will nuke you. It's a bargaining tool.
Talking about madmen, whose side are the Muslim rulers on?
So this has been quite interesting because what you're finding is no Muslim ruler is openly coming out on the side of Iran. So the Gulf countries are clearly not with Iran. We're hearing behind the scenes they've been supporting the Israeli attacks and American attacks on Iran. On other occasion, now it's gone on too long. It's affecting oil prices. The closure of the Straits of Hormuz affects Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, Saudi, all of these countries as well. So they've always been antagonistic towards Iran. They believed by being on the side of America, America gave them a security guarantee for America to come and defend them. And what we've seen is America hasn't come to defend them. What we've seen is drone strikes and military strikes in the Gulf countries, and America's been nowhere to be seen. In fact, America said, you're on your own. If you look at Jordan, Jordan actually helped Israel defend missile strikes coming from Iran to Israel. So they're very clear on what side they're on. Syria, Ahmed al-Sharaa, he's with the US, but there's nothing much he can really do. There's no war going on in his country against Iran. Although he technically overthrew Bashar al-Assad, he was aligned with Iran. He's got bigger issues to deal with, but Ahmed al-Sharaa in Syria is firmly in the American camp, although they're not physically doing anything against Iran. for Turkey at the moment is pretty quiet. Turkey, you've got a big problem. You know, it's a player in the region. It doesn't really want to openly take a side, which in my opinion is even worse. By not taking a side, how can I trust whose side you're on? You could be stabbing me in the back. Then you've got Afghanistan. You know, Afghanistan has a border with Iran. They've got antagonistic relationship with America at the moment. However, they're not physically had to do anything. They've openly said that they're against America, what they're doing in Iran, but they've not had to physically do anything. So what you're finding is no one has openly come out on the side of Iran. None of the Muslim countries. I think most of the Muslim world is with Iran. Most of the Muslim world is with Iran because it's standing up against Israel. It's standing up against America. And once again, the Muslim rulers are completely out of sync with the sentiments on the streets.
Adnan, one of the countries that's been massively affected due to the war is Pakistan. Pakistan has been chosen to mediate between the warring parties. Why was it chosen in the first place?
So for Pakistan, this is probably the proudest moment for them in their history. The Pakistani media has gone into overdrive. Pakistan's leaders have gone into overdrive that, oh my God, you chose us. We are so honored. We are so happy that you chose us to be the location and the people that are going to mediate. Now, it's very important to use a cricket example. Pakistan is batting on the side of America. It's in the American team and it's the third, fourth, fifth batsman. That's what's going on here. This isn't their a neutral mediator. They are in the American camp. And effectively, Pakistan has been asked, you need to help us get out of this. You've got to help us progress this because everything America's done for the last 10 weeks has been a complete failure. Now, it does help that Pakistan has a relationship with both countries, Iran and America. Pakistan has a border with Iran. Pakistan has a relationship with Iran, good and bad, over recent history. So by choosing Pakistan, Iran would be open to these negotiations. They'll be open to actually coming. But what Pakistan is doing is just hosting. It's not doing anything more. Pakistan hasn't come up with its own terms. It hasn't looked at the terms of both Iran and America, come to the middle ground and said, look, these are terms you guys should agree. Pakistan doesn't do that. It's literally just a venue. It is like a weekend away where we need a meeting room to come and talk. And they're the hosts. They're the waiters. They put out the chair and table for you. That's actually what they've been doing. However, if things get worse, America could say to Pakistan, we need you to support and fund an insurgency in the border area that you have with Iran. And that would create a whole host of issues. Because this is effectively what Pakistan did in Afghanistan. In the Afghan war, Pakistan batted for America. It gave America supply lines. It supported America. It handed over individuals and groups to America. It basically was an arm of America in Afghanistan, and that's why their relationship has completely gone down the drain now with the Taliban. So that's possible. So although Pakistan's role has just been to mediate, there is a possibility going forward America wants Pakistan to play a bigger role, and this will cause a whole host of issues going forward because Pakistan will probably then align with America, and that would now mean that you've got problems with the Taliban in Afghanistan, and then you're going to have problems with Iran as well. In fact, the Iranian delegation, the two leaders for the delegation that went to Islamabad, they are now saying that Pakistan is not a neutral mediator. Pakistan is on the side of America.
Am I correct in thinking that Pakistan is actually the mouthpiece of America? What America wants to actually say and what it's actually feeling, it's getting Pakistan to do it for them.
There is that as well, but I think when we put it that way, it gives Pakistan some credit that America went to Pakistan because, you know, you're a reliable guy, you can do that. Pakistan is the battered wife, the abused wife in the relationship with America. And Pakistan hasn't learned its lesson. Look at what happened in Afghanistan. Pakistan still had military sanctions against it from America. This is the reality. So they still, you know, the abused wife keeps going back to the partner. That's the nature of the relationship. So when America says, we need you to jump, they may not like it, they may not agree, but they will fall into line, which is historically, unfortunately, what's happened. Now, it doesn't have to be like that. There's actually, Pakistan could play a much bigger role. It could play a better role. The fact that America keeps reaching out to Pakistan shows how important Pakistan is. But the Pakistani leadership, the military leadership, unfortunately, they just feel just by being on the side of America, that's good for Pakistan. That's good for them personally. The fact that the world is changing, the fact that Pakistan should even think about, are you even on the right side of history? Things are changing now. I mean, the American empire isn't looking good. Are you really even on the right side of history? That's how they should be looking at it. But this is, you know, this is probably a podcast on its own. The relationship between Pakistan and America, there's what they present. The reality is Pakistan is the abused partner in this relationship.
I feel you're not giving Pakistan too much credit there. I do feel Pakistan has got one eye open towards its security pact with Saudi Arabia. So if Saudi Arabia is attacked by Iran, Pakistan is automatically brought into the conflict as well. Surely, you know, the army, Pakistani army, and its rulers have that, you know, at the corner of their eyes.
So I think, Imran, the security pact they have with Saudi Arabia is purely based on Pakistan needed money, Pakistan needed investment, Pakistan needed help with all the debt it's got, and the IMF is obviously a problem, and no other country is going to loan it money. Even China's had enough of loaning money to Pakistan. So because of how things are in the Middle East, this Saudi deal became perfect. So the Saudis are saying, look, we want your military support. We want you to be based here, and you're going to have to deliver if and when we need you. Pakistan believes, what's the likely chance we're going to have to military deploy and go to war for Saudi Arabia? Very short-sighted, and that actually may not be far. The worst thing for Pakistan would be they have to physically deliver on that security pact. That would be the worst case scenario for them. Their belief seems to be, we get money, we can pay off our debt, we can deal with our deficit. What's the likely chance we're actually going to have to deliver? Because even if you look, the security agreement between America and the Gulf countries, America believed, look, when are we going to have to deliver? What's the likely chance there's a war that goes to such an extent where we have to deliver on our promises? And now what's happened is they failed to deliver on their promise, and look at what's happened. So I think that's actually what's going on. And again, you know, with these security deals and these pacts and alliances, you can only really measure them once you have to deliver on them. Because, you know, there was a special relationship between the UK and America. Every politician should keep talking about it. And now America's really put it into perspective that it was just on paper. It's not real. How is Britain going to help America? In fact, now Trump keeps talking down to the British and the British leader. So until you don't need to deliver, it's just an agreement on piece of paper. And actually, it will be a big problem. If Pakistan has to help Saudi attack Iran, Iran's on your border, Saudi's not even on your border. So this opens up a whole problematic can of worms for Pakistan. And this is what happens when you're not, you know, you don't have strategic foresight, when you're not independent, when you're dependent on America, when you believe by siding with America is good for you, you're going to get into these gymnastics, political gymnastics, because you're not thinking things through and you're not actually putting your nation first. What you're putting is yourself first, or what you think by being with America, it will be good for you. And as Iran has learned and the Taliban has learned, doesn't matter how good your relationship is with America, that can very quickly change.
The next question is probably one of the deepest questions that we've received. To what extent is this conflict about ideology versus geopolitical control?
Yeah, that's actually a very, very good question. And I think this comes from a context. There was a time where America went to war, it had disputes, but a lot of this was about ideology. You had the Cold War. You know, the alliances, the support for proxy groups, the support for foreign military development, it was wrapped up with ideology, but there was a Cold War. You had capitalism versus communism, America versus the Soviet Union. You saw in the 1990s, there was all this talk about democratizing the Middle East, spreading our values, free trade, globalization. However, what you find now is for at least the last 5 years or since Trump, you're seeing it go the other way. You're seeing less and less ideology. You're seeing less and less values promotion. All you're seeing is raw geopolitics. What you're seeing is we've got the biggest hammer, you need to get into line. So if you look at America, they're now putting tariffs on the world. So that goes completely against free trade. You're seeing in America, if you criticize Israel, you are being banned and you're being deported. You're seeing every sacred cow America had, they're being slaughtered one by one by one, whether it's economics, whether it's democracy, whether it's free trade. According to Trump, the 2020 election was robbed. He was robbed of the 2020 election. And this is supposed to be the biggest democracy in the world. What you're now seeing now is where it's pure great power competition. We've got the biggest military, so we can go and kidnap your president in his bedroom. We've got the biggest military, we can do a decapitation strike. You don't even see Trump say, oh, but we want to democratize you. Oh, we want you to embrace liberal values. That's completely gone out the window. And what this shows you is America now effectively has abandoned and contradicted its values so much that they no longer even promote it. What they're now saying is, we are the biggest tiger in the jungle. And if you are on the wrong side of us, or if we don't like you, we will come and bite you. As we've seen in Venezuela, and as we're seeing play out in Iran. And what this does, it creates, it opens up a whole new world. It basically means there's now global powers changing. The global balance of power is shifting. Which nation can now step in? America's not even promoting this is what we stand for anymore. And, you know, these things don't end well. Once you abandon your values, it means you're past your peak. It means you just don't even care about telling people that your life could be better. And now it's all about we're stronger than you. And what happens in every case that's happened in history is this power eventually goes into a war it shouldn't. It ends up losing, and this undermines everything it stands for, and the global power changes. We saw this in World War II. We saw it in World War I. We've seen it in empires in the past. So actually, the whole invasion and war of Iran is very telling where America is. It's very telling what America is not. And these things don't bode well going forward.
But surely, I mean, I don't actually blame America for not wanting to promote its ideology. Surely you promote an ideology where another ideology exists, but the whole world is in the same camp. So surely they've got nothing to promote because they've got the world in their palms to a certain extent.
Yeah, see, the problem is, yeah, America seems to be doing everything that contradicts the ideology. It seems to be doing the complete opposite to the ideology. In fact, it's doing things that hurt the ideology. So when you are banning protests in America, when you're deporting people because they are saying things that you don't like, you are now contradicting the very values you believe in. When you're passing legislation where you ban people for criticizing Israel, or you ban them from coming to America, and then you pass legislation that if you don't allow free speech, if you don't allow, if you restrict American online accounts, we're not going to let you into America, you're contradicting your values. And when you contradict your values, what happens is you undermine and you weaken your standing in the world. And that's when these sort of empires resort to using iron grip, using the biggest hammer. And that's where we are with America. And I think this whole Iran-Iraq war, you know, we've talked a lot about the military perspective, the political perspective. This is actually the more worrying. And that's why in America, you've got people questioning now, what's the point of the empire? What's the point of all this money going abroad when I, as an American, can't feed my children, can't send them to school, can't pay for their college fees, can't send them to uni, can't afford healthcare? What is the point of the global empire when at home, it doesn't serve me? And when that happens to all empires, it's the beginning of the end. We saw it with the Soviet Union in our lifetime, and we're seeing it now with America. So yes, if you are an American elite, you're looking at how do we maintain the American empire? And what you say is, look, forget the global order, forget all the leg up we gave to the world that served us for so long. That's just too expensive now. We have to restructure and decide what's priority. But what you're doing here, you're abandoning all the things that made you who you are. You're abandoning all the things that people believed we want to be part of because it's good for us. Now you're abandoning it. So that will lead people to think, actually, you never believed and you don't act upon what you say you should believe. So take these tariffs Trump's putting on the world. This is the country that promoted globalization and free trade since World War II. Now it's doing the complete opposite. So this is actually a much bigger issue, really, in the grand scheme of things. You know, we could talk about America's not winning, they're not decapitated. I mean, this is actually a much bigger issue. And that's why, how does America promote that? I mean, how does America even promote we're the good guys? It would have been before, we're the right civilization, we believe in values that are good, and we're promoting this around the world, and people bought that. They're not even doing that anymore. In fact, now Americans are saying we're the problem. Americans are saying the elite in America, they are the problem, because they've got this empire thinking. Whilst what we need to do is put America first and think about our own country. So you're absolutely right. There's probably no need for America to promote values because the whole world is basically liberal, or to some degree they believe liberalism is the only ideology for the world. But there's a problem when all your actions are contradicting it. Because what this will do, it will lead to the emergence of an alternative ideology. It will lead to the emergence of an alternative nation with another ideology. And that will just be way more attractive than these liberal values where politicians don't listen to you. You got wealth inequality going through the roof, and where people barely survive in an economy that doesn't actually work for them. And this is why, if you look, you know, people are a bit more positive about China. They see that China just doesn't have the problems that they have. So yeah, this conflict has very little to do with ideology. It's all raw politics, raw geopolitics. It's great power competition. And look, you know, if you lose a war, then that means you're not even that powerful anymore. So at least before, America stood for something. Now it's like, well, we got the biggest military. Yeah, but you're fighting not the greatest military in the world and you're not winning. And actually, when the last time America won a war? This century, America's only lost wars. So even from the biggest hammer perspective, America's not looking good.
The next question is a two-in-one question. First part is, what are the chances of Iran collapsing? And the second part is, what happens if Iran wins?
In terms of Iran collapsing, this is possible if a few things happen. There is talk of America escalating now, because what America's strategy at the moment is, let's hurt Iran by blockading. So let's hurt them economically. Let's hurt their exports. If that doesn't work, which is very likely, there is a possibility America are escalating this, and then they target Iranian energy infrastructure, their water resources, all the infrastructure needed for people. That would be a big problem for Iran, because that would put them back decades. And that's if that happens. Now, this action is being discussed to force Iran. What America is saying is, if you don't come to the negotiating table, if you don't roll over, this is an option for us. However, I would say, I don't really think it's an American interest for Iran to collapse. You've got this country of 90 million people. America wants to use it. America wants to work with it in order to shape the region. That is how America looks at Iran. So whether that's being antagonistic, whether that's by containing Iran, or whether that's been cooperating with Iran and working together, destroying it, it's just too big a country. It'll be 100 million people soon. It's a huge territorial nation. It borders the Caspian, Central Asia, South Asia. You've got the Straits of Hormuz, then you've got the Middle East. So really, you want to use this country rather than completely destroy it. So I think it's very unlikely. However, if they want to destroy it, that's what you'll do. You'd have to target all the infrastructure that allows a society to function. Now, what happens if Iran wins? If Iran wins, this would be the Berlin Wall moment. Now, if you take your mind back, the Berlin Wall came down in 1989. And when it came down, everybody believed the Red Army will be sent in. The Soviet method of dealing with rebellions was the Red Army would go in and deal with everybody. And when the Berlin Wall came down, that didn't happen. And what that told everyone is the Soviet Union's finished. The fact that it can't even defend its most important republic shows you that the problems have got to such an extent where dealing with East Germany is no longer even a priority. That was 1989. 2 years later, the Soviet Union collapsed. So if America loses and Iran wins, it means America's not powerful. It means a weaker country has defeated America. It would be the end of American power in the region potentially, and even the world. And it would mean that we are now in the situation where there will be a change in the global order, because countries like China, countries like Russia will look at this and say, we need to go in for the kill. We need to move into the area because America's weaker now. So if Iran wins, that is, you know, it's a global changing situation.
Right. Final question for today, Adnan. What should we be watching out for? And what will you be looking out for?
So I think the key thing to look out for is, look, what does America do to save face? And I think it's got a couple of options. And I think we've got to look at these to see which ones potentially America will do. I think one possibility is Trump calls it a day. Just not worth it. Got big issues to deal with, right? I'm not sure how he's going to navigate that, because it would just humiliate him. But there is a possibility, and that's something, you know, I'd be watching. The other option is America just escalates this massively. Now, for that to happen, America needs to move military equipment, troops into the region. So that's what you're going to be really looking for, is how much movement of troops are there? How much movement of transporters are there? America will need further bases in the region as well. So if they're doing that, then the likely chances they're going to escalate. And then the third thing is talks. The talks haven't worked up to now. The talks still seem to be continuing in some form or shape. I haven't seen any back-channel talks now, which is quite unique. Usually there's some back-channel talks going on, which then become the formal talks. Trump being erratic doesn't help. But what that means is he's losing. What that means is he's so unhappy with the reality in front of him. He's so unhappy that the reality is not going in his favor. That's why he's doing tweets which are just ludicrous. That's why he's saying things which are just bonkers. That's why the people around him have now run out of things to tell him and to things to lie about, because it's just not actually working. So the more erratic Trump gets, that's actually an indicator that he is not winning. That's actually the evidence he's not winning. And the reason why he's erratic is he just doesn't know how to deal with this. He keeps tweeting, oh, I've spoken to Iran, they're about to give in, we're just about to win. And he said that so many times. So the question, why is he saying it? Because he has to say something to his base. He said, no more wars. That was the election campaign. Yeah, no more wars, America first. So that's why he has to end this war. That's why he just keeps lying. So I think these are probably the three areas. You know, does he call it a day? That looks a particular way. Does he escalate? Then certain things have to happen. Or will talks be the way they pursue? These are probably the key things that I'm going to be watching. And I think they'll be they'll give a good insight into the direction things will go.
Adnan, thank you for your time today. If you want to learn more about the issues raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolicy.com, which is all one word. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website, where you will find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Imran. Thank you for listening.